Six music.
BBC Radio's Six Music documentaries, telling the stories in music that matter. Now.
Simply put, the Jesus and Mary Chain are one of the most influential alternative rock bands of all time. From the mid-80s to the mid-90s, they built a bridge between classic underground pop like the Velvet Underground and the Stooges over to a whole new distortion-loving alternative rock movement, inspiring bands across the world like My Bloody Valentine and Dinosaur Jr. They were also renowned for the incredibly fractious relationship between the Scottish-born brothers at the core of the group, dual vocalist and guitarist William and Jim Reid. After six albums, including their seminal debut Psycho Candy, the band split in a fury of drug abuse and increasingly violent arguments in 1999. But they did reform to play a triumphant set for the Coachella Festival in 2007. Now, in the wake of a career retrospective, I spoke to Jim about the band's formation, their turbulent history, their reunion, and the complex and unpredictable relationship that lies at the heart of one of the most volatile rock and roll bands ever. And I started, as is traditional, by asking Jim when he first became aware of music as a child.
The first song I can remember is probably She Loves You by the Beatles.
Classic start.
I remember when I was, a baby, I'm talking about very, very young, I remember singing She Loves You. I remember singing Yeah, Yeah, Yeah for the adults around, and I remember, like, if I did that, I had a little plastic guitar, and if I did that, I got a sweetie. So probably the significance of that is less musical and more to do with the fact that I learned that if I showed off a little bit, somebody'd stick a toffee in my mouth or something.
She knows. Yeah. You know you should be glad. With a love like that, you know you should be glad. With a love like that, you know you should be glad.
What about the first record you owned? The first piece of vinyl that was yours, that you possessed?
I remember my auntie gave me and William some 45p record tokens, and that bought you a single in 1973, and I bought Hellraiser by Sweet. William wasn't his first record, but he bought Drive-In Saturday by David Bowie. And both of those records have kind of been important to me. Obviously, Hellraiser was my first record, but I remember listening to Drive-In Saturday, and I remember sort of... I had no idea what the song was about. I mean, to be honest with you, I still don't know what it's about, but... I loved it, the kind of like sort of dreamlike, you know, sort of strange, sort of, you know, probably druggy, but I didn't understand that at the age of 12. And it wasn't like years later when I was like travelling around America in a band, and I'd be like, and I remember like lying in a hotel room about 5 a.m, like a zombie staring at the TV and just flicking from one channel to another. And I just remember thinking, Drive-In Saturday. This is Driving Saturday. This is like, I swear David Bowie must have written that song on a tour of America while he was doing too much of stuff that was bad for his health.
Let me put my arms around your head. Gee, it's hot, let's go to bed. Don't forget to turn on the light. Don't laugh, babe, it'll be alright. Pour me out another phone. I'll ring and see if your friends are home. Perhaps the strange ones in the dome can lend us a book. We can meet up alone and try to get it on like once before. When people stared in Jagger's eyes and we scored. Enough to keep formation mid this fallout saturation, cursing at the astronaut that stands in steel by his cabinet. He's crashing out with Sylvia, Euro supply for aging men, with snorting head he gazes to the shore. Once it rains, the sea rage no more, like the video films he saw. It's a crash course for the ravers. It's a driving Saturday. Yeah. His name was always Buddy, and he'd shrug and ask to stay. And she'd sigh like Twinkle Wonder Kid.
First gig you went to, did that have a similar impact?
I went to see The Jam at the Glasgow Apollo.
How was that?
Oh, that was great. I mean, it was loud. I just remember that I thought my ears were bleeding. I mean, it was so bloody loud, I couldn't believe it. I mean, first gig, I'd no idea what to expect, but I just didn't think it was going to be that loud. And I remember for days afterwards, I was like, what? People going, Jim, do you want a cup of tea? Like, hey, what? And it was like, it was amazing. It was like, that was it. That's, you know, sort of kind of like, there and then thought, well, that's what I want to do for a living. I want to make people's ears bleed.
So was it the gig more than maybe recording music that inspired you to make you think that that's what I want to do?
Well, I mean, if I think back to it, I mean, I remember, you know, there was a point where I remember like, that I had decided that music was going to be important to me. And back to Sweet again, I remember listening to the Top 40 rundown on a little transistor radio just outside my house, probably about, oh, I can't remember, 73 or whatever. And listening, it was Blockbuster was number one. And I remember listening to Blockbuster on that little transistor radio. And I remember it was the first time I'd ever got like a shiver up my spine. And the hair stood up in the back of my neck. I mean, it could have been that it was Scotland and it was winter, but no, it was like, basically, if music was my religion, you know, that's when I found God at that moment. I mean, basically, that record just sounded, then I just thought, well, I want to do this. I want to be in a band. And then it wasn't until like years later, I suppose, with like, yeah, stuff like the Jam and punk, that all of these kind of out of focus, diffused elements like that I realised were important, so I came into focus. And it was punk that made me realise, well, me and William realised that we were going to one day make music. But, you know, we're the laziest people on earth. So we ran out and bought guitars and they sat in the corner of the bedroom for about 5 years and we sat downstairs talking about starting a band.
Did you draw logos and stuff and all that kind of stuff?
We weren't quite that sad, but all right, Christ, we did, okay.
You mentioned the impact of seeing the Jam and punk. What about kind of, I suppose, proto-punk would be an apt genre description. Can you remember the first time you heard the Stooges?
The Stooges. I mean, I'd heard of the Stooges before I actually heard them, because basically every punk band on the planet talked about them. And then we went out and bought Raw Power, And it just sort of blew us away. I mean, the cover was brilliant. I mean, the picture on the cover, you could buy it for that alone and you'd be getting your money's worth. But the music was just, like, fabulous. It's not a duff track. I mean, there's 8 tracks on it, I think. But, you know, any one of those tracks is, like, sort of worth it for the price alone. It's just a brilliant record. I mean, it was the first time that I think I bought an album where you didn't want to lift a needle up from start to finish. You're waiting on the next track. You're like, oh, every track sort of does its job.
First band then, because you weren't Jesus and Mary Chain straight away.
Yeah, it was a Jesus and Mary Chain straight away. That was our first band.
First rehearsal? There wasn't just the pair of you in the corner of the living room.
We used to rehearse in this little community centre in East Kilbride, and we'd no transport. The only way we had it was about half a mile away, and the only way we could get the gear there was we stuck sort of casters onto the bottom of the amps. It was like me, William and Douglas sort of like wheeling all of these amplifiers down the street to the community centre, you know, to rehearse. And it was like community centre was like free, and it's like, I don't know, we'd be in there Tuesday nights, like Wednesday nights it'd be like sort of Blue Rinse Brigade playing bingo or something like that. Tuesday nights it'd be the Jesus and Mary Chain in rehearsal and stuff.
Did it feel exciting as soon as you started putting it in the framework of we are this band, we have this name?
I think once we kind of actually got together and started rehearsing, I mean, it took a long time for us to get to that point, but once we did, I think we started to get, you know, into it more and started to realise that this was actually going to, well, we thought it was going to happen. So, yeah, as soon as we started rehearsing, I think that when William came up with the name, and when we had the name, that was it. It was like a train, it just wouldn't stop.
What was the first gig like?
Well, I mean, it was all right. I mean, we couldn't get a gig in Glasgow. It was just like such a kind of like insular little music scene there. It was all kind of hip sway and, you know, guys, everybody seemed to have at one point been in Altered Images or something like that. No harm to them, but we couldn't get our foot in the door. Nobody would give us a gig. And then we kind of hooked up with Bobby Gillespie, who had a mate in London, Alan McGee, that was doing a record label, and it had a club called The Living Room. So I think it was more as a favour to Bobby that Alan sort of booked us to play The Living Room. And we went down and we were something like third on the bill. I think it was Micro Disney were the headline. And when we went on to play, there was about 6 people watching us. And I remember I didn't care, 6 people watching us, but we were on a stage and we were playing in front of people. And it was like, you know, and during the day, we'd sort of, for the first time, we'd met McGee. I think he just thought we were like sort of psychos or something like that. It's like 10 minutes after meeting him, me and William started like lunging at each other because we hadn't been getting on that day. It was a hot day. We were getting on each other's nerves. We just introduced ourselves and then started swinging at each other. Me and William, he thought, these guys are nuts. And then we did the sound check and he just started raving about album deals and blah, 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 5 albums, and yeah, it's amazing, it's genius, and that was it.
Tell me about the first single.
Well, we had no idea how to go about recording in a proper studio. We went in the middle of the night because it was cheaper. We were all kind of like, you know, a bit tanked up, got down there with a big stack of beers, which was probably a mistake. We started mixing on the big bloody Tannoy speakers, which, you know, it sounded like, we were like, whoa, I can't believe we sound that good. And then we sort of like up all night, you know, tinkering around with it. And then we sort of went away home, stuck the tape in a ghetto blaster, and it sounded like crap. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. You know, last night we sounded like the Velvets. Today we sound like Dire Straits. What's going on? You know, it's like, somebody said, well, did you mix it on those big bloody Tannoys? I'm like, yeah. So I said, well, you got to go back and mix it on the little radio speaker in the middle, which is what we did. But we decided that there was too many people, too many cooks, so William and Alan went back to remix it. Because where we were mixing it, I mean, it was that classic, you know, everybody in the band wanted their bit up louder stuff. So we decided it would be better if we kept it to McGee and my brother.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Velvets there, actually, which is obviously another one of the kind of touchstones. When did you first fall in love with them?
Well, again, it was another one of those bands that all the punk bands name-checked. And we'd bought Transformer, but hadn't heard anything by the Velvets. And I remember hearing I'm Waiting for the Man when I was in the bath. I used to always hear songs for the first time when I was in the bath, because I used to always play the radio when I was in the bath. And it came on one Saturday afternoon when I was in the bathtub, and I was like...
Listening to The First Time with Jim Reed from the Jesus and Mary Chain.
Six Music.
BBC Six Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time with Jim Reid from the Jesus and Mary Chain. And that was the Mary Chain's Everything Is Alright When You're Down. I asked Jim whether the band's first trip to the US in 1985 was something of a culture shock.
It was as if we knew it. You know, it was almost like, you know, I mean, basically the America that we were interested in was gone, really. I mean, the bands like the Velvets and the Stooges, that was ancient history, really. But America, I mean, it went to New York in March 1985, signed off the Dole in January. It was just like, whoa, you know? And it was like New York was just exactly like the way I thought New York was going to be. It was kind of dirty and sleazy and fun. And it was just, it was like every second of that trip was like a party, really, you know? And it was weird. I mean, I still not really quite sure how it all came about, but we went there to play club, the Danceteria, and we played two nights there. And I hadn't really realised it at the time, but I mean, basically we were brought over, the promoter Ruth Polsky, that used to bring loads of English, British bands over to play in New York, the first gigs. But I hadn't realised it was going to be like a club. I thought these people were actually coming to see the Mary Chain, and I was like, walked out there, I thought, this is pretty cool. I couldn't even imagine these people could know we exist. And that was the first night, and it all went pretty well. The second night, it was like people were breakdancing. It was like they were really just spinning around the floor and breakdancing. I was like, well, no, something's not right here. And it's like we started cranking out the noise, and people just like sort of, it was like that bit in The Producers when everybody's jaw dropped, you know. But yeah, it was fun.
You always seem to have quite an affinity with the States, though, in terms of your fan base and...
A lot of the things that we were interested in, sort of like cultural landmarks, I guess, were American. You know, sort of movies like Taxi Driver, or, you know, sort of books by William Burroughs, or, you know, certainly music by the Velvets, Stooges, Suicide, and... New York Dolls, Ramones. I mean, yeah, a lot of the things that set us on our road were American. I mean, a lot a lot of those things weren't. I mean, we're into sort of British punk and British culture too, but there was a kind of a version of America that we were fascinated with.
How long were you playing for live at the time? This is one of the other kind of myths that always surrounds the band in terms of these very short 20, 25-minute sets.
We did do a couple of very short sets, not as many as people say. I mean, basically, when people were paying peanuts to see the band, we figured we could do what the hell we wanted. We didn't play 15-minute sets by the time it sort of got for real, if you know what I mean. I mean, the idea wasn't even ours. I mean, we'd heard about it from the fire engines and stuff like that. We just sort of thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, you go out there and why bore people to death? Go out, you got this like sort of manic noise. It's not going to, I mean, this isn't Bruce Springsteen here. It's not going to work for like 2.5 hours. So go out there and make it like an explosion and, you know, just leave people in a state of shock. And that was the thinking, and it worked. I mean, it really did work. I mean, we went out there, we just basically exploded, blew up in people's faces, and people would never forget that band again.
I have to ask about your first Peel session, it being Six Music. We are the keepers of the John Peel legacy. That's always a fantastic moment in any band's life.
It was great. I mean,
what do you remember from the day?
Well, I mean, the actual recording of it wasn't ideal, to be honest with you. I mean, I remember, like, trying to talk the engineers into, you know, certain things that they weren't so keen on us doing.
Turning it up.
We wanted to record Broken Glass, and they wouldn't let us. We wanted to break bottles and record it.
Health and safety, mate, can't do that.
And we were saying, but look, there was a big oil drum in the corner, and we said, look, do it inside the oil drum, glass goes nowhere, stick it in there with a mic. But they wouldn't do that, and that was a bit unfortunate. But so what? I mean, we got to record 4 tracks for John Peel, and it was great. And I remember when it was broadcast, I was back in East Kilbride, and I took my dog for a walk with a wee transistor radio while it was on. And I remember just walking around East Kilbride thinking, this is weird. I'm on the radio. And I stopped at a supermarket, and there were people in there, sort of like, and security guys that were in there listening to the radio, and I was looking in the window at them listening to John Peel, and like playing like the Mary Chain, sort of like getting a strange feeling about it, you know.
I'd like to trip you. I'd like to trip you. I'd like to trip you.
Guys, off your second record, Darklands was your first top 10 hit. As a band who's always loved pop as well as, or the art of pop as well as kind of punk, did it mean a lot to have a top 10 single?
It was, yeah, I mean, it did. I mean, I sort of grew up watching Top of the Pops, T-Rex, like Bowie on Top of the Pops, Slade, Sweet, you know, I loved it, and that's what we wanted to be, and that's what we wanted to do. And I love punk, but it kind of disappointed me when bands like the Pistols and the Clash wouldn't do Top of the Pops, because I wanted to see them on Top of the Pops, you know? And, you know, other punk bands did, and it was great. The Ramones on Top of the Pops, the Buzzcocks, the Saints, it was fabulous, and that's where I wanted to be.
Didn't you get banned from Top of the Pops once?
Not really. I mean, I think there was some candy talking almost got banned by the BBC. Mick Smith wouldn't play it or something like that. And but we sort of said, well, is it banned? And he was like, no, I'm just not playing it. If he had banned it, it would have gone to number one, but he didn't.
Tonight, the damp and hungry place tonight should always
Mood of the band like around that time, around the, you know, reverence time? Was it starting to get harder work?
Around about, well, Reverence and Honey's Dead, I mean, we kind of felt a little bit kind of like outsiders by that time. The whole kind of like Manchester thing had happened and we didn't really know where we fit anymore. And we'd been kind of struggling to get radio play and, I mean, the time of day generally. And we kind of just almost like just sort of thought, well, who cares? And we just like stuck out Reverence as a single, just expecting it would sink without a trace. But it did all right.
Was there a point when the drinking and the drug taking, you thought this is getting out of control, this is going to be damaging to the band as well as maybe our health? Was there a point when you started to think in those terms?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I always kind of knew that it couldn't go on like that. You know, it was probably the mid-90s was probably when it got at its, you know, sort of most out of control. Yeah, and I thought, well, one day I'll sort this out. It's just that day just kept getting sort of further ahead of me. And I did eventually. I haven't had a drink for 5 years now, so I mean, I consider myself sorted out in that respect. But it was getting out of control. It was out of control.
On a subject of out of control, the House of Blues in 1998, which is one of those gigs that's passed into legend. There's lots of legends that seem to surround you guys. So what happened?
Oh, I mean,
is that the sigh of a man that's told this story too many times?
Well, no, it's painful to remember it, to be honest with you. We weren't getting along. We hadn't been for quite a long time. The recording of Monkey was like going to the dentist for, you know, sort of 2 months or something like that. It ended up with Monkey that he went in and recorded all of his songs with the rest of the band. I went in and sort of recorded my songs with the band. It wasn't a band anymore, you know? It could have been, and, you know, I've said often that, you know, someone should have really been around us. Someone should have spotted this and said, well, send them, you know, opposite directions, get them away from each other for a while, and it'll probably sort itself out. But instead, somebody booked us into a big bloody world tour. So that was it. So there you have it. We're sitting in the back of a tour bus in America. We can't stand the sight of each other, and it's this little claustrophobic space. that we have to share. And we got about two dates into that tour. It came to blows. I mean, actually, the House of Blues, what happened was we actually came to blows in a van on the way back from the gig the night before House of Blues. And William said, well, that's it. I'll play tomorrow's gig and I'm out of here. And that just, like, you know, I spent the whole day. Basically, I didn't go to bed that night. Spent the whole day just getting absolutely rat-arsed and what have you. By the time the gig came, I couldn't stand up. I just couldn't stand up. And I just remember, I mean, it was memories of just ranting and raving at William on stage, but in front of the audience. And then basically the promoter just said, this is not music, pulled the plugs, gave everybody their money back. I mean, that's the only time. I mean, we play some pretty messed up shows, but that was the only time we ever actually had to give the audience their money back. That was it. And I had to do the rest of the tour with the band without William.
That must have been very difficult.
It was very strange. And I remember the next gig, it was the most bizarre gig you can imagine. I don't know how come it happened, how we got booked. We got booked into this, like, supper club somewhere, like, I can't remember where it was, in San Diego or something like that. I mean, it was the first gig without William, feeling all fragile and frazzled. And I walk out and there's people eating steaks and sort of like linguine in the front row, and I'm like, what's going on? It's like Spinal Tap.
When did you first decide or think of the idea that a reunion was going to take place?
People had been trying to get us back together for quite a while, and it was... the Coachella people, they kept coming at us, and at first said absolutely no way.
Why?
Well, I didn't think he'd be interested, William. And he was the same. He sort of thought I wouldn't go for it. And then we kind of talked about it, and I sort of said, well, I thought you weren't keen. And then he was like, yeah, well, should we go for it? And that was it.
What was the first gig like then?
The first gig was terrifying. It was the first time I'd played with the Mary Chain sober. I mean, that was terrifying enough. You know, it was just like we'd this club gig, I think the day before Coachella, and we played it and it went well without a hitch. And then, I mean, being Mr. Pessimist, I was like, oh, for Christ's sake, we shouldn't have booked that gig because now this one's going to be a disaster. I was nervous, I was shaking, but I don't think it showed. And it all went well.
How's your relationship now?
It's not ideal, and it never will be. But we kind of know how to handle each other a bit better now.
Why do you say it never will be?
Because just too much has happened. You know, just too much has happened that can't be undone. I mean, basically, for things to be the way they once were between me and William, you'd have to go back in time and destroy the Jesus and Mary Chain, really, you know? For a while, we were almost like sort of Siamese twins at the beginning of the band, but that quickly, you know, that went. And then it was like we were just basically fighting for space in this little confined space called the Mary Chain. That's what it was. It was just like, I don't know, 10, 15 years of sort of like fighting for your own little bit of ground.
We finish with, it's been all these firsts and all these firsts. We finish with the last. It's the last track. We can play anything you'd like. It's your choice. It can be something of yours. It can be something that means a lot to you, new or old.
Well, I'll play something by someone else. I'll play Beasley Street by John Cooper Clarke.
Why that track?
Well, I just have always loved it. And it's another one of those songs that I heard for the first time in the bath. I just think that, you know, every line in this song is like a punch. You know, it's just, there's nothing, nothing's wasted. It's something I wish I could have done. It's just a wonderful record.
It's been really good to speak to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Far from crazy pavements, the taste of silver spoons, a clinical arrangement on a dirty afternoon, where the fecal germs of Mr. Freud are rendered obsolete. The legal term is null and void in the case of Beasley Street. in the cheap seats where murder breeds. Somebody is out of breath. Sleep is a luxury, they don't need a sneak preview of death. Belladonna is your flower, manslaughter your meat. Spend a year in a couple of hours on the edge of Beasley Street, where the action isn't, that's where it is. State your position, vacancies exist in an ex-certificate exercise, ex-service men excrete. Keith Joseph smiles and a baby dies in a box on Beasley Street. From the boarding houses and the bed sits full of accidents and fleas. Somebody gets it where the missing persons freeze. Wearing dead men's overcoats, you can't see their feet. A rift joint shuts, opens up right down on Beasley Street. Cars collide, colours clash, disaster movie stuff. For a man with a Fu Manchu moustache, revenge is not enough. There's a dead canary on a swivel seat, there's a rainbow in the road. Meanwhile on Beasley Street, silence is the code. Collar an inspector calls where the perishing stink of squalor impregnates the walls. The rats have all got rickets, they spit through broken teeth. The name of the game is
this is BBC Radio
6 Music. 6 Music. 6 Music.